As I said this morning, chapters 12 to 14 of the book of Revelation are probably among the most misused and abused of all the chapters in the book, and perhaps even in the entire Bible. I am reminded when we start looking at things about dragons and beasts and all those kinds of items, reminded of the old, and I believe it's European ditty, from ghoulies and ghosties and long-leggedy beasties and things that go bump in the night, good Lord preserve us. And that's kind of what we have here when we read these chapters, or maybe even the whole book, is that idea from ghoulies and ghosties and all kinds of beasties. Since especially in these chapters we have imagery, apocalyptic imagery, that is used to talk about individuals and nations at the time that the apocalypse was written, to talk about evil in general as it inhabits our world. Chapter 12 in the book of Revelation, the woman and the dragon, is how the heading in my Bible reads here, bless you, is an abruptly new section of the book. In Revelation 11, the author has brought us to the point of talking about messianic judgment and the arrival of the kingdom of God. Rewards and punishments are pronounced upon those who are faithful and those who are not. And with spoken word, these things seem to have been accomplished. It would appear that the book should be at the point of ending. However, there's suddenly more to tell, or at least a continued retelling. Because some of what we find in chapters 12 to 14 are just as the seven seals and the seven trumpets and the seven bowls that will come along later are talking about the same events in different acts. So it is here in chapters 12 to 14, different imagery is used to relate some of what we have already seen in the book and some of not only the historical situation when the book of Revelation is written during the reign of the Roman Emperor Domitian, but also the way it is written allows it to be pertinent to any generation of Christians living in the world. But it is almost like the curtain has fallen at the end of chapter 11 on Act 1, and in chapter 12, the curtain is raised on Act 2 of the play, and it's a continuation of the same theme, much as in a play, the same theme runs throughout the various acts. And we do need to remember, especially at this point in the text, that the book is not a chronological account of the final end, or even a chronological account of the time in which it was written, or to which it spoke. As Mitch Reddish writes in his commentary, the sequences are arranged not chronologically, but thematically. Here, the struggle between God and evil is depicted in a new way. And I quote, "Viewed in light of the overall structure of the apocalypse," that's the book of Revelation, 12:1 to 14:20 functions as a break in the action, a pause to present a close look at the assault on the people of God by the forces of evil. John's great parenthesis is inserted to illustrate the struggle between the church and the forces of darkness. What we have here is, in this imaginative language, in this code, at the time when Domitian is doing a lot of things to Christians and Jews that Nero had done to Christians earlier, we've got a new portrayal of the life and death struggles that confronted the church of his day under the Roman Empire, and in particular under Domitian, who considered himself at least descended from Apollo, if not Apollo himself in the flesh. and that Roman Empire as a whole, the church and the Roman Empire with Domitian. Domitian, who reigned from 81 to 96. And he had become, for those people, the incarnation of evil. Remember, we said early on in this study that far too often we forget that evil and evil actions have a human face, because humans perpetrate that on other humans so much. And John has come to the point to understand that the conflict is more than simply political or religious. It's the same struggle that has gone on since creation, actually. And he uses mythological language and images to show how serious this struggle is, and that the readers themselves are part of that struggle. Not just with Rome, but part of that struggle in their daily lives. And once again, not just with Rome, though Rome takes the brunt of that. In their daily lives, in other ways, as chaos enters life. As that chaos attempts to overrun and overthrow God's desires and God's intended order. Now, that in some senses is the result of free will that God gives in the beginning. But both risk and honor of God takes place in relationship. And what this will say here is, and what John will say is, if you remain faithful to God in the face of conflict and uncertainty in life, whether that is from outside forces like the Roman Empire or others, or from your own internal struggles in life, you help defeat evil when you persevere and witness unto death. And your death is not in vain. And that's what we as Christians hold on to. I mean, part of chapter 14 is often read at funerals about the rest of those who have been faithful. They can rest from their labors. 14, 12, and 13. And that's part of the hope that we have. That if we persevere in all of the chaos that is around us, we will find that rest, and our perseverance will not be in vain, but we will be in God's presence. The struggle of the people to remain faithful, as seen in their endurance against emperor worship, is part of the great conflict in the world, in fact in the whole cosmos, between the forces of evil and the forces of God. And Reddish writes, "By painting their problems on a cosmic canvas, John is giving added meaning and significance to all of their struggles." And so when we come here to Revelation 12 to 14 with images that we associate very much with the book of Revelation. Images of, you know, bizarre images of beasts, of Antichrist, of all kinds of other things. We find that John, who mixes all type of Jewish and non-Jewish stories as well as his own political situation, is still trying to tell us that no matter what happens in the world, and no matter how badly it may seem to be going, and no matter how much it seems like the bad guys or the bad situations are going to win, if we remain faithful to God, God is going to win out and we will be preserved. It's kind of, and some of the images we have here are kind of like Paul's writing in 2 Thessalonians, where he talks about the man of lawlessness must come first before the end, and he's being withheld for a time until certain other things happen. So it's not just a theme of Revelation. It's a theme in the New Testament that there is evil in the world. Oftentimes that evil has a human face, but that God still has a purpose and an intention, and that it is God who allows and disallows things to happen until that intention or purpose is fulfilled. Now, we do have to be careful as we study Revelation, and particular in these chapters, of two things. On the one hand is something that that scholars have to be very careful about, and that is getting so involved in dissecting every little minute detail that we lose the larger vision of God's providence. That is a danger. And I admit to sometimes being part of that danger. Years and years and years ago, I was filling the pulpit for the minister where we were going to church, and he was gone off. His wife was there, and he told me the next week after he had come back, she looked at him and she said, "You know, I never did really figure out for a while what Steve does and how he does it, but I've come to the conclusion that he takes the text and builds a little bomb in it and explodes it, and then starts picking up the pieces and trying to put them back together," which I guess was kind of an accurate description. And so that's the danger from that side, is that we can get so involved in exploding the text and then trying to nitpick all the little things out of it that we can lose the larger picture. On the other hand, we also have to remember not to make the symbols mean whatever and mean more than their historical situation warrants. So that's the other side, is that we take them to such fantastical conclusions that Schwarzenegger and others get rich making movies. Or other people pass off this kind of fantastical stuff as the gospel truth when it's really not. So those are the two sides of the coin that we have to be careful about. But we also have to remember, as we use imagination's eyes, that beasts and dragons occur and recur throughout history. And that's really what this is about, is how those beasts and dragons, not literal beasts and dragons, but those chaotic things, those evil things, continue to pop up throughout history. And we have to be careful and be aware of them. Now, I used a word a while ago that I want to kind of get out here and give a brief definition before we move along. I said that he uses a lot of mythological language. And myth is a forceful, one definition is a forceful conveyance of truth that express insight, longing, and experiences of humans. The word myth doesn't mean, we think of it in the modern and postmodern world as meaning false. That's not the case. Myth in its original context is, myth is the story that serves as a vehicle to express truth. So it's not falsified. It's not something just made up. It is the story, the kernel of the story itself, that carries that truth. So when you're talking about religion, and in particular when you're talking about biblical texts, and somebody uses the word, somebody in scholarship especially uses the word about the word myth, it's not, he's not saying, or she's not saying, this is a falsehood. He's saying this is the vehicle where we find truth, is that story. And so the form in chapter 12 to 14 is very much centered on a typical kind of understanding of combat myth in Judaism, in Christianity, as well as other places. Those stories found in various cultures expressing that struggle between good and evil, that struggle between light and darkness, the struggle between order and chaos. And so what we find here then is not something that's false, but we find these stories that are the vehicles to express that cosmic struggle. And that cosmic struggle, it doesn't just take place in heaven, it takes place here on earth. And in this particular instance, takes place during the time of the Roman Emperor Domitian, with the persecutions of the church. Also, even these chapters, 12 to 14 of Revelation, with all of its strange language and its misuse and abuse over the eons, tells us the story of Jesus. Jesus the Lamb. Jesus, who struggled against evil in his earthly life. struggled with temptations, struggled in exorcisms with the demons, struggled in life with healings, and struggled with persecution by religious leaders as well as friends toward the end of his life, but who ultimately defeats evil by his life, death, and resurrection. And in these chapters, we find him depicted as the resurrected, the living Lamb, who was sacrificed but who is now alive. But we must admit that for John's original readers, there was political significance. For you see, emperor worship was in vogue, and many of the emperors claimed divinity. I have already mentioned that Domitian claimed divinity and affinity with Apollo. And John is trying to show that the real victor is Christ, not the emperor and not the state. Now, when we come to this chapter, then, a great portent or celestial phenomenon appeared in heaven. A woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant and was crying out in birth pangs in the agony of giving birth. Now, this woman represents overall heaven, the abode of God from which the Christ child comes. The child that is to be born in this chapter represents Jesus, the Christ who has come. Then another portent appeared in heaven, and a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on the heads. In other words, it's 7-headed, got 10 horns, each head's got a crown on it. That's the diadem. His tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. Then the dragon stood before the woman who was about to bear a child so that he might devour her child as soon as it was born. She gives birth to a son, a male child, but her child was snatched away and taken to God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God so she can be nourished. And then there is one of those numbers that really is not a significant number. The woman in labor, as I said, represents the coming of, and the child born, the coming of the Christ child. The dragon represents all that is evil and chaotic and in opposition to God. The 10 horns symbolize the strength of evil, not 10 nations, as some people have tried to say. It simply represents the strength of evil, and the 7 heads with 7 crowns represent the authority that evil often has over people. You know, we don't have to teach a child not to pick up something off the shelf that's not theirs, do we? We don't have to teach them to do that. We have to teach them not to do that. Excuse me, I had it just backwards. We don't have to teach them. We don't say, hey, now when you go in here, just pick that up and walk out with it. No, we say, don't do that. Because there is that tendency, however innocently it may be sometimes, to do that. What he's saying is evil is real in the world. Chaos is real in the world. And it needs to be taken seriously. But we must be careful when we look at this and not make more out of it than is intended. The author here, in this particular time frame, the author is talking about evil in particular as it is persecuting the church through the emperor and through the Roman Empire. But it can be used regardless of time in history to represent the struggle between good and evil in the world. A struggle which we as Christians believe was overcome. A lot of folks make a big deal out of the next several verses in chapter 12 with the archangel Michael, and it's all kinds of fantastical claims have been made that this is the primordial casting out of Satan from heaven and all this kind of stuff. But really, that's not the case at all. Because Michael did not cast the devil out of heaven. Michael didn't have the strength. What we have here is a description of a heavenly, an earthly event with its heavenly counterpart. The writer is not describing that overthrowing of Satan before the foundation of the world. Because when was the actual defeat of evil and Satan? When did that take place? In what event? Crucifixion / resurrection. In that event, with two parts, the crucifixion and resurrection, that's when actually evil was defeated. Not before the foundation of the world. John is not trying to explain the origin of evil in the world here. And war broke out in heaven, and Michael and his angels fought against the dragon. And the dragon and his angels fought back. What he's trying to talk about here is the fact that there is evil in the world. And there is evil all around. But that evil is overcome by God. And in particular, the hymn that we find in verses 10 through 12 helps us to understand that that evil is overcome by God in the Messiah. In these verses, we find this pronouncement. We find the overthrow of Satan is celebrated as the arrival of God's salvation, God's power, and God's kingdom through the authority of His Christ. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven proclaiming, "Now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of His Messiah." Handel once again. The kingdom of our God and of His Christ. That is when the power came. "For the accuser of our comrades has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. But they have conquered him, not by the sword, and not even by the sword of Michael the archangel. They have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony." While we do have an end time event seemingly talked about here, actually the end of the rule and the reign of Satan takes place at the sacrificial death of Jesus, the blood of the Lamb, not the raising of a sword. And the accuser, which is in Greek diabolos, in Hebrew hasatan, the Satan, the accuser, is overthrown. And no matter what the accuser can bring, these verses talking about they've been conquered. They've conquered by the blood of the Lamb, by the word of their testimony, for they did not cling to life even in the face of death. "Rejoice then, you heavens, and those who dwell in them. But woe to the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you with great wrath, because he knows that his time is short." All of this is overcome by the fact that those who are faithful in Christ to God, the accuser cannot raise anything against them in the presence of God. And so there is that assurance here that regardless of what happens in your life, regardless of what chaos enters your life, whether it's from the empire or from things that go on in your heart or other things that you might say or do, if you will bear faithful witness to God in Christ, He will vindicate you and protect you, and the accuser cannot have anything to say against you when you appear before God. Why? Because he's already been defeated. So this is still the story of Jesus, who has come and lived that life, has overcome in life, in death, and resurrection. That is, in his living, in his death, and in his resurrection, he has overcome anything that the accuser can toss out there, including death. So why Michael? Because oftentimes in this time period, as I said, there was this sense that what happened on earth had a counterpart in heaven, and what happened in heaven had a counterpart on earth. But the heavens and the earth were not totally separated. Why? Because God was God over all of it. Some Christians, early Christians, some within Judaism, and certainly some within the Persian religion that shares a lot of belief in that time period, and before with Judaism and Christianity, Zoroastrianism, there was that belief that, in particular, when something happened, a conjunction of planets that had never happened before or been recorded before, or a new star, that that was a sign in the heavens that a great person had just either been born or come to the throne on the earth. Why that belief? Because there was the belief that God was over it all and connected it all. And do we not believe that God is over it all and connects it all? The story here reminds the readers in John's day of the story of the cross. And verse 12 celebrates both Christ's victory and what the martyrs contribute, that is, perseverance of the saints and true believers, both in the face of death and in persevering as Christian witnesses in their daily struggles. We talk about martyrdom and the martyrs, but as we've mentioned before, while that oftentimes is connected with the death of someone for their belief, the word in Greek martyrios simply means witness. We are called to witness regardless of what goes on in our lives or in the world around us. We're called to persevere as Christian witnesses until we die, whether it's die for our belief or we die after a long, long life still believing and still witnessing. In that way, the text is very personal. It's not this fantastical vision of movie magic. It's a practical vision that says even when chaos seems to be winning, if you will remain faithful to God, then you will never stand apart from Christ. Now, there are different ideas about the pursuing of the woman into the wilderness. Some say it reflects the Exodus tradition. Some say it is a reflection of the first Jewish-Roman war in A.D. 66, where Christians fled Jerusalem into the wilderness to hide. But whatever it is, she is preserved according to the text. She is preserved and protected, and it's a reminder that God will preserve the faithful. God will preserve the faithful. And the use of the term Satan in all of this, or in different places in the book of Revelation, is a way to remind folks that there is a face to evil, and a way to remind folks that evil, while it is present in the world, does not have the final say-so. Does not have the final say-so. Now, in chapter 13, we have some of the most vivid images from the book of Revelation. The beast from the sea, Leviathan. From the earth, Behemoth. The number 666. The mark of the beast. And images of one we call Antichrist, even though actually the word Antichrist never occurs in the book of Revelation. Not once. The imagery, though, shows the same struggle as in chapter 12. It's just from a different perspective. In chapter 12, we have this image of a battle in heaven. Now, in chapter 13, we've got an image of the same battle on earth. Just as there is a cosmic struggle out there, so there is the same cosmic struggle here on the earth with us. The beast from the sea and the dragon both have, by the way, if you look at it, they both have 10 horns and 7 heads with 7 crowns. So it's telling the same story from a different perspective. It's not a separate account and not a separate entity. And in fact, it is just another manifestation of the dragon or the face of evil with Satan on the earth. It represents, really, in some senses, the embodiment of the Roman Empire and its emperors with their divine titles. Chapter 13, verse 1. And I saw a beast rising out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and on its horns were 10 diadems, and on its heads were blasphemous names. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard, its feet were like a bear, its mouth like a lion's mouth. And the dragon gave it his power and his throne and great authority. Many of the emperors, as we've already said, claimed divinity. Domitian claimed divinity with Apollo. Domitian, by the way, was the sixth Roman emperor to claim he was divine. There's that number six. And as we have mentioned before, 666, if you take Neron Caesar in Greek and add up the numeric equivalents of the letters, you come up with 666. Or if you take the Greek word for the beast, Therion, and transfer that into Hebrew letters, guess what? It adds up to 666. It's a reminder by John that Domitian is Nero's face of evil. And that face of evil in the Roman Empire. And he tries to say here, the emperor claims to be divine, but emperors, kings, presidents are not divine in any way, shape, or form. And in this particular case, the way Domitian acts, he is saying that not only is he not divine, but he's somewhat demonic. And if you think about it, one of the other things that makes this book in some ways relevant, regardless of the generation, is every generation can find its Neron Caesars. Those who are the face of evil and chaos and seem to be against God. In fact, the dragon and beast from the sea, many scholars see as parodies of God and Christ. And the passive verbs that are used here help to see that, as well as help us to see that God is not the one who gives evil, but God sometimes allows these things to happen. What it meant to the Christians at the time was either that Nero, there were some who taught that Nero didn't really die, even though according to history Nero stabbed himself in the throat and died, but that he didn't really die and he was waiting for the proper time to come back and say, "Here I am alive," and rule and reign claiming divinity. Or what's more likely is Nero died, people believed he would come back and be reincarnated, and so they equated Domitian's reign and rule with that. Domitian, who was a beast, another Nero. Interestingly enough, the seven churches to whom letters were sent earlier in the book of Revelation are all strategically located geographically, chronologically, and culturally in the most heavily distributed imperial cult cities in the Roman Empire outside of Rome. Those seven letters that we talked about in Revelation 2 and 3, the cities to which those were sent were where outside of Rome the imperial emperor worship cult was the strongest. For example, five of those had imperial altars with statues and opportunities to sacrifice to the emperor. The only two of those cities that did not have imperial altars were Philadelphia and Laodicea. All of them, except for Thyatira, had imperial temples erected and dedicated to the emperor and emperor worship. That is, the worship of the state and its leaders. And five of them had imperial priests that oversaw all of that. Statues of the emperors were very prevalent in the event in the cities. Festivals to honor the emperor's birthday, as well as major accomplishments in the emperor's life, you were expected to participate if you were part of the culture. Your civic duty was to participate in these festivals to these emperors, which made it very difficult for Christians who very legitimately asked the question, if we live in these cities, just how far can we go in being good citizens? Does that mean we also must worship the emperor as well as Christ? because you had to be involved in emperor worship if you were a good citizen. And John is saying to worship the emperor, that is the beast, is to worship the dragon, that is Satan, the arch enemy of God. And the chapter is filled with parodies. God and Christ, that is the dragon and the beast. Parodies of praises to God in the Hebrew Bible, where folks say in verse 4, they worship the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast, and they worship the beast, saying, who is like the beast and who can fight against it? We can go to the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament, and find many places where it talks about who is like God and who can fight against him. And so this is a parody of that relationship. The authority of the beast is given over every tribe and people, language and nation, which is a parody of God's authority and Christ's authority over all of the universe. And the passive verbs in verse 2, in verse 5, the beast was given a mouth uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority. In verse 7, also it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. This passive is not a claim that God makes evil, but a claim that even the forces of evil eventually must answer to God, because God is supreme. God allows it to happen, God doesn't make it happen, and eventually they all will have to come to His throne. Very much, once again, like what Paul writes in 2 Thessalonians. That the man of lawlessness is being held back for a time until certain things happen, and then he will be released and made known. And that faithful believers will not just endure, but faithful believers must persevere. Let anyone who has an ear listen. If you are to be taken captive, into captivity you go. If you kill with a sword, you must be killed. Here is a call for the endurance and the faith of the saints. Regardless of what situation in life or in the world confronts you, you are called to persevere and to remain faithful. As Eugene Burring writes, all who support and promote the cultural religion, that is the state religion, in or out of church, however lamb-like they appear, are agents of the beast. All propaganda that entices humanity to idolize human empires is an expression and an acceptance of beastly power. And so what John is saying here is, regardless of what you see, you need to be careful. It is a call for endurance and faith, not to give in to any of the state religion, civil religion. We sometimes call it, even though generally civil religion is neither. Not true religion, nor is it very often civil. The second beast, which is another parody of this relationship, Behemoth, is simply a retelling once again of all of this, where the inhabitants of the land have to make a choice. And really, the choice, and we talk about those who can buy or not buy because they've got the mark of the beast or they don't. I think I got one of those things in here. Remember years ago when they said it was your buy-low card? The buy-low card was the mark of the beast, because you couldn't get those deals if you didn't have your buy-low card. That all of those things are really a way of saying that anything that we allow to take in the chaotic world, that we allow to take precedence over our faithful endurance and perseverance with God, separates us from God. And we need to be very, very careful that we do not allow anything to separate us from God. We must remember that as the church, we are called out. We're to be a body distinct from the world, but we're in the middle of the world. And we live in the middle of the world. And here, at this particular point in time, these Christians are having such a difficult time wondering if they are going to be able to live or die or even make a living. Wondering if when they leave their homes, if they'll return or not. We find here a reminder. A reminder that the only one who is truly to be worshipped and the only seal that we truly need to wear is that of faithful servants of God. Which then takes us into chapter 14 with the Lamb and the 144,000. The 144,000 that stand with the Lamb. Then I looked, and there was the Lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him were 144,000 who had his name and his Father's name written on their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven like the sound of many waters and like the sound of loud thunder. The voice I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps. That's where people get the idea that angels fly around with harps. And they sing a new song before the throne and before the living creatures and before the elders. No one could learn that song except the 144,000 who have been redeemed from the earth. It is these who have not defiled themselves with women, for they are virgins. These follow the Lamb wherever He goes. They have been redeemed from humankind as first fruits for God and the Lamb. And in their mouth no lie was found. They are blameless. By the way, the references here that they haven't been with a woman and all that kind of stuff, that's not really a sexual reference, and it's not intended to be such, and it's not intended to say that women have no place in heaven. Though some people, in fact some monks in the monasteries in earlier centuries used to teach that. But it is a reference to here, and there is no lie found within them. It's a reference to those who refuse for the sake of themselves, who refuse to give in to emperor worship or to false worship. They have remained pure in the way and faithful in the way that they have remained loyal to God and God's message. 144,000 with the Lamb, those are the same people as found in chapter 7. They are those who have not bowed down to the beast or to the state or to the emperor and earthly authorities. They represent the faithful redeemed who stand with Christ and who stand for Christ. And while initially he is talking here about those who have not committed religious fornication or adultery, who have refused to proclaim Caesar or king or president or any other except for God as Lord, they are the first fruits of all the redeemed. They're the ones who help set the precedent, who are the examples to which we look. But even more so, the 144,000 is not a literal number. As we said the other week, it's a significant number of completion and wholeness. And what he is saying here is, even in the middle of the chaos, if you remain loyal to God and faithful to God in your worship, then you will stand with Christ. And the accuser cannot keep you from standing with Christ. It's a reference not to just a small little group. It's a reference to all who remain martyrios, witnesses to the end. As I said, whether that life is ended because of your religious belief or whether it's at 105 years old and you take that last slow breath, but you've been a witness. Those who are faithful will be redeemed and stand with Christ because they have stood for Christ. What does that have to do with us today in the next 2 minutes? It's not 2 minutes till seven, but in the next 2 minutes, what does that have to do with us today? There's so many things, so many chaotic events that happen in our world, but there's so many chaotic events that happen in our lives, whether it is sickness, whether it is some disaster that has fallen upon a family member or a friend, whether it's a loss of a job, the loss of a spouse through death or perhaps through separation and divorce, the loss of a child, or so many other things, the loss of a best friend. For some, it might be loss moving away from friends, changing schools, changing neighborhoods, maybe even changing sides of the country. And yet, what the text says for us is that while evil and chaos often has a human face, there is someone and something that can overcome the chaos if we remain faithful, and if we endure, and if we persevere. And regardless of what ghoulies and ghosties and long-leggedy beasties and things that go bump in our night or our day there might be, good Lord can preserve us. That means going to keep things from happening. It's good Lord preserve us even through that. And that's the message of these chapters. It really is. For us to be careful, to be prudent, and to be faithful and faith-filled so that we might endure and find the preservation of God, regardless of what else happens around us. We've got a few minutes. Any question or comment before? Yes, Susan. We do find in some of Paul's, a couple of Paul's writings, we find reference to those who are antichrists, people who are against Christ. It's actually in Paul's writings and translations of Paul's writings that we end up with the word rapture. The word rapture never occurs in the book of Revelation either. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, when Paul says that when the Lord comes back, we who are still here will be caught up in the air so to meet Him and be with Him forever. And when Jerome was translating the Greek text, he used the Latin word rapturo, which means to be taken up or caught up. And that's where the whole word rapture comes from and where that idea comes from. And actually, if you look later in the text and those the sections where people point to the idea of rapture and being raptured out and the church being raptured out, if you look at it, it's actually, if you take it literally, it's the martyrs who have been beheaded are the ones that are taken out. Not everybody else. Everybody else has to stick around and wait. But the martyrs who've been beheaded for their faith are the ones taken out. But we find in the letters of Paul a couple of references to those who are against Christ or anti-Christian. And then as the church, we find it showing up more and more, not only in church doctrinal writings, but we find it in some of the non-canonical writings in the New Testament, Apocrypha, some of the Gnostic writings found at Nag Hammadi, Egypt, and other places. You get this whole idea. But it really appears as well in some of the pseudepigraphical literature that occurs with the Old Testament Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha in between the Testaments and beyond, where you've got this good versus evil in such places as 1st and 2nd Esdras and 1st Enoch and places like that, this whole cosmic idea. And in Christians later, looking and reading those as being prophetic, even some of those non-canonical things, because until the mid-4th century when the canon was set, a lot of things that we don't find in our Bible, a lot of Christian churches in that part of the world read and used in their services. And so that's where those ideas come from, that along with the whole understanding that the dragon, the beast, whatever that is against the things of God. And so if it's against the things of God, and we find in the text that God and Christ are one early in the book, then if it's against God, then it's against Christ. And the Lamb represents Christ, and this was a battle against Christ. But the word Antichrist itself does not appear in the text. Others? If not, then as you go, know this. If we remain faithful regardless of the chaos that enters our lives, regardless of the ghoulies and ghosties and long-leggedy beasties and things that go bump in the night, God will preserve us if we are faithful and remain faith-filled. God bless you. Go in peace. Amen.